Welcome to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists share what they have been working on. I'm Eric, and this week I am excited to share with you my conversation with Linda Skidka. Linda is a distinguished psychology professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where she runs a very prolific lab on social, political, and moral psychology. Linda is a former president of the Society for Personality and Social Psychology, and her research has appeared in outlets such as Science Magazine, The Huffington Post, and The New York Times. We chatted about her exciting new work on what she calls moral conviction. Without further ado, here is our conversation. Today, I have the big honor of talking with Linda Skidka about moral conviction. What a fascinating topic. Thank you, first of all, for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
So you have this wonderful new review piece in Annual Reviews on the psychology of moral conviction. What is moral conviction and why do we have to care about it?
Moral conviction is a meta perception people have about some attitudes. It's basically the degree to which they see that attitude is reflecting something that they see in terms of morality or immorality, right and wrong. So, and we can see of it kind of like another dimension of attitude strength, just like some attitudes we see as being personally important to us or that we're especially certain about. Moral conviction is another kind of meta perception that people can have about some attitudes.
So how do I know if I'm morally convicted about things?
That's up to you. You know, that we see it as a subjective impression that people have about some of their attitudes, that they feel it with the force of moral conviction. So it's something that you subjectively experience. It's not something that a researcher is going to tell you, oh, yeah, we know you're morally convicted about that.
So what are some of the questions to get at moral conviction?
Very face valid items, items such as to what extent are your feelings about whatever the issue is a reflection of your core moral values and convictions? Or are they based in your beliefs about fundamental right and wrong? Or it reflects a core moral principle to you?
How do I subjectively, from my own point, come to be morally convicted about things? Do these things just pop up and I'm morally convicted about things? Do they develop over time? How do I develop these intuitions?
That is the really million-dollar question. we've studied the correlates of people's perceived moral convictions and the consequences of their moral convictions, and are only really beginning to start to address, well, where do moral convictions come from? And how do attitudes come to be moralized in the first place? And maybe even a bigger question is, how can we demoralize attitudes? To the extent that we have know anything about those processes so far, it appears that maybe two processes are involved. One, if your attitude is already in the domain of preferences or convention, you know, just like maybe you prefer to eat meat, one step that would need to be involved is the possibility that that could be moralized. So it's a process of moral recognition. Which could happen through just by exposure to media or persuasive appeals or some kind of moral shock. But we think that the moral recognition takes a little bit more effort and more cognitive appraisal to achieve. But other attitudes, you might already be aware that at least some people moralize them, even if you don't happen to. Like maybe your position on abortion is just a preference that you prefer a backstop birth control method, but you may recognize that other people have already moralized that topic and some reasons why they might have moralized that topic. And so we see moralization in that domain would be moral amplification. There would already be some recognition there, but something happens that leads you to create a stronger moral conviction about it than you start out with.
Do emotions play a role? I know this is a really unfair question, and you have a very detailed analysis of what emotions play a role in what way in your paper. And I can only link listeners to read the paper, but just a high level, maybe one emotion that you want to focus on, or some key takeaways that you want people to have.
Emotions definitely involved. I think there's much clearer evidence that emotions have the power to moralize than there is evidence, for example, that recognition of harm can moralize. The research evidence on recognition of harm and its association with moralization is relatively inconsistent. There's some evidence of it, but it doesn't always show up. But there's very consistent evidence that emotions seem to be involved. For example, in one study, participants were exposed to a number of disgust-relevant stimuli. So they were exposed to pictures of toilets that were overflowing, or they were exposed to pictures of aborted fetuses, or they were exposed to pictures that were equally bloody, but that were animal rights violations, or there were control possibilities as well. And the only thing that moved around people's moralization of abortion attitudes was exposure to the aborted fetus pictures. Hmm. And the exposure to those pictures also had to happen at conscious levels of awareness, which seems to suggest that attitude moralization isn't necessarily intuitive, but it does seem to be very affectively motivated. Mediational analyses revealed that it was just perceptions of disgust and not anger and not perceptions of harm that was leading to attitude moralization in that study. And then some longitudinal studies about what led to moralization of political candidates, both people's feelings about their preferred and non-preferred candidates, revealed that changes in perceived harms and benefits of electing a candidate did not predict subsequent moralization of their people's attitudes about that candidate over the election cycle. However, changes in perceived hostility towards non-preferred candidates and enthusiasm for preferred candidates did lead to stronger moral convictions over the election cycle. It was also interesting that fear was one emotion that did not. So there's pretty good emerging evidence that emotions are going to be one of the important factors that does lead to attitude moralization.
Can we trust people when they say that a certain attitude is a moral conviction that they hold? So one of the really fascinating aspects that I want to talk about is one of the consequences of moral conviction that you mentioned is the idea that the ends justify the means, right? This is my moral vision. I have come to see the light. I know the utopia that we all have to be striving for. And if we have to kill some people along the way, then, you know, that's fine because the utopia will justify it, which seems, you know, somewhat problematic in many instances. And sometimes I wonder, some people really just want to kill people for the sake of it or for power, for getting ahead, you know, stabbing someone in the back in the organization, but they wouldn't admit it, right? They're like, why did you do this? Oh, I just want more power. That's not a justification that many people would be happy with. And so instead, they seem to be just casting whatever they did in some moral narrative. And like, oh, no, I was doing this because they were harming the organization and I just care about the organization and the organization is helping the world. And, you know, this way we're going to solve climate change or some just story that they make up that is really not compelling. So to what extent is that true or just me being cynical and too critical of human nature?
Well, we haven't explicitly studied people's genocidal motivations yet. however, we do have a lot of evidence that people do seem to be willing to accept almost any means to achieve a morally preferred outcome. They certainly will accept lying and in contexts that are actually about political strife, they are willing to accept more collateral damage in order to achieve a moralized preferred end. And certainly some people are going to say that the ends are instrumental, for example, that they are perceive themselves to be an existential threat. They may or may not moralize that, but people are willing to accept collateral damage sometimes for instrumental goals, too. I'm not sure if that's entirely answering your question, but...
Yes. It's just really fascinating because... So one of the things that I found in the organizational literature that is like, how do we find out if someone who's interviewing for a job is going to steal from the company? You can't just ask them, are you going to steal? Right? They will not say this, of course. But what you can ask them, what is actually going to predict whether they might steal, is how prevalent do you think theft is in the company? Right? Because the kinds of people who would steal, they're like, well, everyone does it. So might as well do it. And then they overperceive the environment as more hostile and competitive than it really is. And then they would say, you know, well, morality, we just have to disregard it as for the weak in some settings. But sometimes it just seems like they would not straight out acknowledge this. And instead, where they might recognize, yeah, other people care about morality, like not really liked by people. You got to get ahead somehow by being liked. And they might just come up with this moral narrative and be like, no, that's just, you know, just really important to be careful. And I just want to make sure nothing gets stolen in the organization. And I really care about things. This is a deep conviction that I have that, you know, no one should be stealing. And so I try to be extra careful, or some confabulation that is really not credible in some sense. And I just wonder to what extent we can trust people when they say, oh, I have the moral conviction about this specific attitude versus something else.
That's a great question. We don't tend to ask people about their moral convictions about things like workplace theft, but maybe we should be. So I can't really answer that question, at least in that particular context. In part because I guess I think about virtues as being maybe something a little bit different than a moral conviction. Virtues are pretty abstract. You know, that thou shalt not steal is an abstraction that may or may not do a good job of predicting people's behavior in a specific context, like that they need a ream of paper at home and take one home from work. Mm-hmm. Whereas moral convictions are more about, I see it as a little bit more tied to outcomes, that I'm morally convicted about, that this is a diverse and welcoming workplace for people of different stripes. And that they would go to considerable lengths to achieve that particular outcome. Or I'm morally convicted about that capital punishment should be banned, for example. So it's less of an abstraction than a virtue or value would be. It's more concrete and specific.
What are some other consequences of being morally convicted about certain attitudes?
Well, you've certainly brought up one of our major findings. The most widely replicated finding is the willingness to accept less legitimate or less fair procedures in order to achieve morally preferred ends. For example, vigilante justice is equally fair as due process of law if you're morally convicted about defending guilt or innocence, for example. Which relates to basically a broader notion about the authority and pure independence of moral convictions. That in many cases, we really tend to go along with what authorities have to say. But when you have a moral conviction, what authorities have to say, what the rules are, et cetera, is not as nearly important as achieving what your morally mandated objective is. But also, you become less concerned about your peers. That research has basically replicated the Ash conformity study, but in the context of where people are being confronted with majorities who disagree with them about something that they're morally convicted about. And whereas you normally see people confronted with majority influence like that, that they will conform to the group norm, but they don't conform if they have a moral conviction about that particular issue. So they don't respond to either majority influence or normative influence as much when people have moral convictions about the cause. People prefer more social distance from people who don't share their moral convictions. For example, you don't want somebody to marry into your family or be the teacher of your children or even to be the owner of someplace of a shop that you might shop at if they don't happen to have, if they disagree with you about one of your moral convictions. People will place their chairs further away from someone who doesn't share their moral convictions. So it's not only just social distance, it's physical distance as well. The people are really repelled by people who don't share their moral convictions. And we've found that the repulsion effect of people towards those who don't share their moral convictions is much stronger than their attraction to people who happen to share their moral convictions. So that's a handful of the things that we found.
That makes me wonder to what extent we're correctly analyzing polarization in the US as, you know, in between two camps, Democrats versus Republicans. And, you know, of course that is happening and people are becoming more polarized and everything gets more moralized in a sense, right? So that makes me wonder if inside and outside of these two camps, we also have more and more just individuals who are completely isolated because they have views that are just not in line with either of these parties, but also a consequence of the moralization of this country. And they're like, well, no one gets it except me, right? I know what's going on, but no one else does. But I'm also so convinced that I'm right that I'm not going to talk to anyone. And also they don't want to talk to me in the first place because they think I'm wrong for whatever reason, because they're misguided, of course. And so we just have more isolated individuals who are just fighting the lone fight, or maybe not even fighting at all because they don't have hope. But maybe I'm overinterpreting things from these findings to like a societal level, which is always dangerous. But I don't know your thoughts.
I'm not sure about the social isolation part, but I do know that people don't tend to retreat about things that they're morally convicted about. That moral convictions also have a strong connection to a perceived obligation to do something in the name of those beliefs. And so we see a strong connection between moral convictions and political engagement, for example, whether that's expressed through voting, activist intentions or actual activism behaviors, volunteering, giving to charitable organizations that are related to that cause. So moral convictions are not very retreat-oriented. They're much more approach-oriented in terms of people trying to seek their desired ends. And they also seem to be another way in which they're approach-oriented is that people seem to be trying to go for their preferred utopian outcome, and they're not so much motivated by avoiding their non-preferred outcome.
So how do we overcome conflicts in relationships where two people have different moral convictions? And each party is like, I love you, dear, but you're just so wrong about this thing, and it really annoys me. And I want to do something about it. And as you said, it doesn't really tie into the withdrawal or the approach, but it still seems to be producing conflict in so many ways. What can we do?
I think it does often cause conflict. It can make for difficult, say, conversations over Thanksgiving dinner. and what, you know, we don't have good evidence in terms of exactly how people cope with that, but I would say what seems to happen is people avoid talking to close others about things that they're morally convicted about and that they already know they disagree. Partly because they do know the consequences of really going there and trying to persuade each other could lead to, real fissure in the relationship. And we do have some evidence in terms of what people self-report that they're going to do if they have to talk to somebody who they don't share their moral convictions with. And basically, they think it's going to be a very dangerous conversation and they're very avoidant having it. They anticipate it's going to go horribly. So that people are aware that this can be one of the dangerous things to talk about. In one of our studies, four people were brought into a room and were actually asked to talk about procedures to resolve something that we're morally convicted about. For example, people were selected. They all had moral convictions about abortion, and half of them had to talk about whether abortion. I'm sorry, there were four people in the group. Two of them were pro-life, two pro-choice. And their task was actually to try to come up with a procedure that would decide once and for all whether abortion was going to be legal in the United States. Okay, and so they had to come up with a procedure. They couldn't decide the outcome. And we had a bunch of control conditions on that as well. And it's the groups that were heterogeneous with respect to their positions on the issue and high in moral conviction that couldn't come to resolution. But one of the most interesting things was about it was how long they took to even tell each other what their preferred outcome was. If the groups were not morally convicted, or if they were not talking about something that they were morally convicted about, they told people their preferred outcomes within the first minute of the conversation. Whereas they waited forever, like typically about 7 minutes into conversation before they would disclose what their positions were. And it was very clear from the videotapes and our coding of the videotapes, just how tense people were in that morally convicted heterogeneous group condition. They were walking on eggshells. And what was partly interesting about it is that nobody knew what anybody's attitudes were at the onset. Yet they didn't know they were in an attitudinally heterogeneous group, but they apparently could sense it. And sense how dangerous the conversation was going to be.
That resonates with so many experiences I've had where you really want to be friends with someone, but then you know they have a strong moral attitude that you might not fully agree with, and you're just so careful not to mess this up, right? And to be careful, right, to walk on eggshells and really to keep the friendship or the relationship, whatever it is, just going despite the differences. Yeah, it's really tough and it's really cognitively demanding to do this.
But I think many people, for example, in the last election were morally convicted about their preferred candidates, and probably more morally convicted than they have been in many other elections. And there were an awful lot of people who did lose friendships. If I understand it correctly, that people were unfriending each other at higher rates on Facebook if they didn't share their political preferences. Some family members are not speaking to each other because of there were differences of opinions about the election. And I would say that those were morally convicted voters.
This reminds me of the literature on sacred values, which is different because those are values, but sacred value is something you're really sure is absolutely right, right? We have to care about liberty, about fairness, whatever it is, and I don't want to compromise on this. And one good way to convince people to do compromise on it is just to remind them of other sacred values that they have, and then they have to do this tragic trade-off, right? And I wonder if this logic can be applied to moral convictions, and if so, if people would also underestimate how often these things occur, right? Because I think that was one of the findings in the sacred values literature where people are like, yeah, I can compromise between sacred values, but you know, in real life, that would never happen. And that just seems wrong because values conflict all the time. But maybe we have this illusion that we don't want to think about how they're conflicting and how that would reflect on our moral character. And so instead we're just like, ah, that would not happen. And I'm just unconditionally, you know, uncompromising on my values, and I just always stick to them.
Again, values tend to be more abstract. You know, that I might have a value commitment to the concept of liberty, but how that gets expressed out at any given attitude position might be may not translate well. For example, people who say that their pro-life positions on abortion, there's lots of other pro-life issues out there. For example, capital punishment, physician-assisted suicide, and so on and so on. And it turns out that people's attitudes across all these life issues don't correlate well at all. So it's really unclear how these more abstract values necessarily get expressed out when you get into concrete policy positions. And a slight difference between, I think there is overlap between sacred values and moral convictions. Although talking to Jeremy Gingis about it, for example, what he sees as similarities and differences is that not all sacred values are moral. And, you know, a real formal definition of a sacred value would be one that you wouldn't be willing to trade for money. And so there's definitely, you know, sets where probably people are highly morally convicted and sacred value would overlap. But probably areas where they would not too.
That still makes me wonder about how we perceive people who are morally convicted. And we might not want to interact with them, but there's still something to the idea that people value someone who stands by their moral convictions, right? Who has certain moral convictions, and people are like, yeah, well, I might not agree, but at least they know what they're doing and they're fighting for a good cause. Of course, it's better if we agree on the cause and agree on the moral conviction, but there is still some appeal to being this unconditionally moral person who's not compromising, who's just, you know, sacrificing everything for this one value, as opposed to someone who's like, yeah, you know, everything's a trade-off, might as well do this, might as well do that. There's just some, I don't know, there are some differences in how we perceive these people.
I think Martin Zoll was the one who did the study, but it turned, you know, if you were morally convicted about feminism, that you really didn't like other feminists who were not as similarly convicted.
Even if they might be very close. From like an outsider's perspective, and people be like, oh, they're all the same, but actually they're not once you're inside the groups. And then there's,
and I think we've all been part of groups like that where whatever the cause is, there's a certain kind of required purity of commitment to that cause, or otherwise you're suspect.
So staying on this broad topic of individual level versus collective level moral convictions, there seems to be a difference between, I have this moral conviction, but I'm a lone fighter against everyone in the world and everyone gets it wrong, versus my group gets it right. We have this moral conviction that we share and we equally want to do something about it, versus everyone else doesn't get it. Because only in the latter case, it still allows us to cooperate with people and to interact with people, versus just being this completely isolated individual who's fighting for, you know, their own cause, and no one seems to care about them, at least from their perspective.
Martin von Zamarin looks at moral conviction really from this more collective perspective, that he, I think he would argue that it, the moral convictions are kind of a politicized group identity that people like me who have this particular position. Some of our unpublished work has actually tried to tackle that a little bit more, is to what degree are moral convictions actually coming out of group identities. For example, I am a feminist, and therefore, as opposed to something that's coming more instead of a reflection of one's personal identity, which would be instead be kind of a sense of personal moral authenticity. I wouldn't know who I am if I didn't take a stand on this issue personally, not necessarily coming from a collective point of view. And so we developed some measures of attitude-specific personal and collective identity about some issues, and asking people, to what extent is your position on this issue a reflection of your personal sense of moral authenticity, right? For example, or who you verily are, versus a reflection of the groups that you belong to and wanting to uphold important group memberships and not letting other people down and that sort of thing. And we've now done three different studies, including a cross-cultural version of the study, and have found that personal identity is a better predictor of moral conviction, even in more collectivist cultures than social identity is, which leads us to believe that this really is more about personal expression of moral commitments than necessarily something collective. That doesn't mean you can't join forces with other people who share your moral vision, but it casts doubt on the idea that this is really a groupy thing as opposed to a personal thing.
So it's really an expression and signaling of one's moral character, more so than it is, you know, a strategic means, in the sense we as a group can achieve this together and we share this morality, so it bonds us together, which is a lot of the moral psych literature, and this is what the morality evolved for and all these things. But it's really more an expression of our character. And, you know, this is the kind of person I am, pursuing these moral convictions that I have.
Right. Although it's not solely that. Interestingly enough, that there's, you know, obviously there's correlations there, but the correlations are not overwhelmingly strong for either social or personal identity. So identity concerns are one thing, but it's certainly not the only thing that moral convictions are about.
What do you think would be the main thing moral convictions would be about, or some other factors that might have just as large an impact or an even larger impact?
Well, again, the role of emotions that are tied to it seem to be really, really important. The things that we get emotionally attached to or that arouse a lot of emotions in us seem to be the ones that we do get morally convicted about. But again, I think that's one of the million-dollar question is really, where do they come from? How do they develop? To my knowledge, there have been no developmental studies of moral conviction as yet. You can come up with a variety of different hypotheses about whether, you get them from your parents and you just internalize whatever your parents felt really strongly about, versus maybe moral convictions are the things that you use to differentiate yourself in adolescence. Okay, this is something I feel strongly about, irrespective of what my parents feel about the issue. I don't know. Those are great questions, and I'm really hoping some people start doing some research in that area.
Are moral convictions interrelated, intercorrelated? So if I have one moral conviction, am I more likely to have another moral conviction? It seems like the emotion-based account would make it hard to argue for this case, right? It's really, if I'm emotional about one thing, then maybe I am.
But yeah, there's not real clear evidence that they come in parcels. We have done research to find out, are some people on average more morally convicted about more things? Yes, there are. That is a thing. Although it doesn't, the people who are more morally convicted about more things don't necessarily look like what you'd stereotypically think they would look like. They are. I thought they would be more dogmatic, maybe more authoritarian. And we're not finding any evidence of that at all. So we haven't published our work on the people who are high moralizers, partly because we can't quite make sense of exactly what does differentiate them from people who are low moralizers. And there is absolutely no tendency for people on the left or right to be more likely to be morally convicted. We've done a huge meta-analysis across many, many issues, and meta-analytic effect size is effectively zero. People on the left and political right are equally likely to moralize any given issue that we've been able to come up with and study. You know, there's a small handful of exceptions on either end, but none of the moments of the market on attitude moralization.
Are there any other intercultural differences that you found? You said you looked into individualism versus collectivism. Are there any other differences that you found?
We only studied individualism and collectivism in the context of personal versus social identity relationship with moral convictions. When we found in the United States that moral convictions were a higher reflection of personal identity, we were worried that maybe that's just because the U.S. is a particularly individualistic country. And so we also are exploring it in India. And we're just getting into that data analysis now. But the preliminary look that we have is that it looks like the relationship between personal and social identity and moral conviction is replicating what we found in the U.S. Two other cultural contexts where we've done some of this work is China. And we find very much the same relationships between social intolerance and moral convictions in mainland China as we did in the United States. That people don't want to be socially close to people who don't share their moral convictions. We did find a difference, though, is that relationship between moral conviction and tolerance does not generalize to political intolerance in the United States. That even if you're morally convicted, you think your opponent should still have the ability to, for example, give a speech about it, run for office, and that sort of thing. Whereas in China, they are also politically intolerant of people who do not share their moral convictions.
Can there be a person who has no moral convictions about anything?
I certainly have many academics tell me they don't have moral convictions about things. And then you start asking them a few questions and you find out they most certainly do have moral convictions about stuff.
Once you start talking about slavery.
Yes, so basically you get into any kind of tolerance issues and they cave.
As I was reading the paper, I couldn't help but think about the virtuous violence literature on how oftentimes, you know, well, I would say moral convictions can lead to, you know, violence and justify the means and all that kind of stuff. What I find really interesting is that if we tie this into the idea of naive realism, where all of us believe that we have the objective take on reality and everyone is just wrong, maybe this explains all of these things together in some coherent sense, right? Where like other people who do violence, they don't share our morality, they must be nihilistic. And, you know, they don't know what they're doing and they're just, you know, nihilistic and have lost religion or whatever it is. And that's why they did it, when oftentimes they really have this moral narrative that we just don't see, because it's really hard for people to realize that their moral beliefs are just, you know, their moral beliefs. Other people might not share them and they might have other morality. It's really hard to see them. And instead of seeing that other people have different moral beliefs, we just think that they just don't have any beliefs. They're just completely nihilistic and we don't see anything. And they're just... we don't really see their moral convictions. And so maybe we would be underestimating outgroups in terms of how morally motivated they are.
I really agree. You know, that one person's martyr could be somebody else's villain. It really depends on whether they happen to be on your team or not, right? American revolutionaries in American history are considered, you know, brave in fighting the just cause. I'm sure the British didn't look at them that way. The British probably perceive them as being terrorists. So one person's terrorist is another person's martyr. It just really depends on whether they're in-group or out-group member.
And there I have the title for the episode. Yeah. there also seems to be this other element, if you share a moral conviction with a group, that makes you feel superior in some ways that we can see with conspiracies right now, right? It's not just that people try to understand the world most accurately, even though these people would claim that this is exactly what they're doing. It also helps you, you know, position yourself in a way that, you know, all at once you're really this smart person who is seeing through things and sees how things really work, how the world really works, and people who have more power than you. Yeah, they might have more money, but they're morally bankrupt and they're all just out there to get you. And they all only got there by virtue of their, you know, coercive strategies, which to a large extent is true, but to some extent is also not. So I just wonder if at some point, you know, developing over time, what started out as moral convictions can really be this identity fused idea of just like, well, you know, this is who we are and this is the kind of person I am, and this is what makes me and what makes us superior in some sense, right? And then you stick to it more than maybe you should in light of the evidence.
That's an interesting hypothesis. To my knowledge, it's one that hasn't been tested. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be interesting just to ask people without reminding them about any moral convictions, just the degree to which they perceive themselves as superior or what have you, versus when reminding them about a moral conviction they have and seeing if you get different effects.
One really fascinating thing you mentioned towards the end of the paper is that economic constraints lower moral convictions, right? So that is, if you are poorer, you also tend to have or report fewer convictions?
No, it's just that if high monetary stakes are associated with something you're morally convicted about, other researchers have found that people will temper their moral convictions.
So what's the mechanism? How does this work?
I honestly don't know.
Let's speculate, because this is a podcast. This is not a paper. So let's just see what we would hypothesize, let's say, for a future project.
I can think about it in this context. Imagine that you're in a political culture in which is under tyrannical control. You probably can't afford to have very many moral convictions in that context, because the cost of actually expressing those, especially if they're at odds with the existing regime, would be too high. So I would imagine in, you know, really tight authoritarian states, people really suppress having moral convictions because it would be honestly too costly for them. Whereas in looser societies that are not under such tight control, you know, genuine democracies, I imagine that people have many more moral convictions, partly because the cost of having them is not so high.
Can we derive moral convictions from propaganda? So I feel like oftentimes people argue, yeah, we just see these television ads and then we're manipulated into buying stuff. We hear propaganda and then we buy into it. And this is how everyone, you know, becomes ideologized. And then Hugo Mercier has written a book, Not Born Yesterday, where he's like, people aren't that gullible, right? It's just really, we could say, applying this here, moral convictions come from emotions, come from identity, come from all kinds of things, but they very rarely come from just being told by some authority, this is what you should believe, because maybe we're not as gullible as it might seem, as we might commonplace believe.
I think it's possible that moral convictions can come through propaganda. Matt Feinberg has been doing some work on demoralization of attitudes about consuming meat. And I wouldn't say what he did was propaganda, but it was a really intense persuasive appeal effort where he exposed participants over a full semester with information about the perils or problems with eating meat, and did find changes in people's attitudes after that exposure and moral conviction. He similarly did it with a MTurk sample where I think they had seven different interventions, and they're showing videos and, I mean, just, you know, tons and tons of information. And that did lead to increased moralization. I think partly that happens through moral recognition, that people probably have just a hedonic attitude about meat. They like it. And he increasingly persuaded them that there was some moral significance there. His motives, I would assume, are quite benign. Yeah. But I'm sure that if somebody really wanted to do a propaganda effort and really try to manipulate people, that it would be possible through emotional cues and persuasive messaging to move the dial.
Even though I guess maybe the propagandists of the world might have a harder job than they would hope for, because it seems like people are somewhat sensitive towards not being, you know, totally manipulated. And there's work on do-gooder derogation, where we really don't like people who just tell us what to do and are like, I did this amazing thing and you should do it. That, you know, usually it doesn't work, and people are just like, who are you? Just leave me alone, right? And just kind of annoyed by these people. So maybe some hopeful news for us and some bad news for the propagandists and dictators of the world, which might be good. At the end of your paper, you mentioned some future directions, and one of them is how moral convictions might develop over the lifespan. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at data for this yet, or if this is just a speculation. What would be your speculation for how it might develop over the lifespan?
I think there might be periods of life where moral convictions might be especially intense. That I think young adulthood might be a period where people are trying out attitudes for size and finding out what they really are morally convicted about. So I would expect passions to be particularly high, maybe at that age, maybe in during middle age when you've got many more demands, you know, work-life demands, family demands, and so forth. Maybe you can't afford to be as morally convicted. Again, because it comes with associated pressures and obligations and sense that you need to do something about it. I'm not sure about older age. But I knew that Penny Visser had some work that shows that attitude importance changes over the lifespan. And so I was wondering if moral conviction might also change over the lifespan.
I have one last question before I also want to give you an opportunity to add whatever you want. Just a very brief, somewhat unfair question, I recognize. But in your Hidden Brain episode, maybe it was just edited weirdly or I misunderstood it, but I think I heard you say the question whether there is a moral truth in the world is an empirical question. If this is what you said, would you mind just very briefly resolving all of moral philosophy here?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciated that question on the Hidden Brain too. please note the sarcasm. I think that's a terribly difficult question to ask. From a research perspective, I would say that it seems to me that morality is in the eye of the perceiver. Okay, that people can probably moralize just about anything. That said, there do appear to be culturally universal things that people do moralize, such as, you know, killing people. And, you know, of course, they have exceptions to those rules, but there do seem to be, you know, extremes that people are going to say that there does seem to be cultural universals about. So, yeah, that's an incredibly difficult question to answer. But here's what I don't believe. I don't believe that there are moral issues that have an essential moral character to them. You know, that abortion isn't by definition a moral issue. Same-sex marriage is not by definition a moral issue. That people attach moral significance to these things. And so if we were just to go out, and actually some political scientists do, is that they just compare what they think a priori are going to be moral issues, which tend to be social issues, and things that are non-moral issues, which tend to be economic or security issues. And I would argue, don't assume those, quote, non-moral issues aren't being moralized. Even if there might be instrumental ends to support war, for example, there might be very strong moralized reasons to support or oppose a war, for example. So I think I really do believe in the importance that we have to ask people if they see something in a moral light in order to understand anything about morality. It's not, we can't make assumptions that people are attaching moral significance to the thing that we think they are attaching moral significance to.
That's a fantastic answer to a really terrible question.
Thank you.
That was great. Is there anything else you want to add or mention before we end?
Just encourage other people to do research in this area. I think it's fascinating. I think there's lots more to do to really understand it. And I just want to encourage this more kind of bottom-up approach to morality. Instead of us coming in and saying, okay, I think all morality is about X, why don't we ask people and find out what the characteristics are, the things that they happen to moralize? It's more of a discovery rather than an assertion of a theory without really collecting a lot of data yet.
Wonderful. Great note to end on. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.